This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Politics grabbed most of the headlines in 2016, but the year was also a big one in science and technology. Here in New Hampshire, hackers caused huge trouble through their attack on the Manchester-based company Dyn, which acts as a kind of switchboard for the internet. And another major hack occurred last month at the state's largest agency, the Department of Health and Human Services. However, the news wasn't all bad, especially in biotechnology. In the Upper Valley, researchers are pushing forward on developments to cure disease, and a brand new national biotech institute is coming to Manchester. Today in The Exchange, what science and tech headlines caught your attention in 2016? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. And by the way, Outside In, Outside Magazine named Outside In the best podcast of 2016. Runner's World also named it one of the best podcasts of the year. Sam, congratulations, and thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Laura.
Dave Brooks is also here. He's a reporter for the Concord Monitor, blogger at Granite Geek. Tonight, Dave will be at the Science Cafe, New Hampshire in Nashua. He'll be discussing cybersecurity. If you want to attend that event, go to nhpr.org. And Dave Brooks, Happy New Year. Good to see you, too.
Always glad to be here.
Well, Dave, let's start with you. You could call 2016 the year of the hack, especially here in New Hampshire. What happened this fall, Dave?
Year of the hack is almost underplaying it. There's some people say this is the year that the internet sort of went from the Wild West to the failed state, which, of course, is exaggerating for effect, but still, it says something. So the big news in New Hampshire, of course, as you mentioned, was the DDoS attack on Dyn. So Dyn is a company in Nashua, in Manchester, in the Mill Yard. We've all seen the big sign on top of the Mill Yard building as you drive past, and it does a number of things related to internet addressing and online stuff. But the main thing it does is a DNS service, which is sort of the address book of the internet. And so when you're going online and you're in your web browser and you type in something, your computer has to know where this site is because the internet is big. And so basically a DNS is the address book. So it uses this DNS to see where to go so it can show you.
So it's really
the page.
Important, basically.
It's the thing that
it's getting you where you need to go.
Exactly. And what happened to Dyn is that they were swamped. That's the best way to put it. It's a DDoS attack, which stands for distributed denial of service, which basically means somebody, and publicly nobody has yet said who did it. Somebody sent so much garbage, emailed so much garbage, sent so much garbage over the internet to them that their servers crashed.
That must have been a lot of garbage.
Well,
because from what I understand, Dave, Dyn works for a bunch of huge companies. I'm like, Amazon and
you couldn't get to Twitter, you couldn't get to Flickr, and you couldn't get
to
sites like that.
Huge.
Because right, so and they those guys are smart and they know about. In fact, they'd given talks about DDoS attacks and the need to defend yourself from them. But what happened was this one was so monstrous, so astonishingly huge. I mean, you're talking terabytes, gigabytes of stuff every second that even Dyn couldn't handle it, and that's what was scary about it. And it. The underlying problem is what is known as the Internet of Things, and an even deeper underlying problem is the fact that the internet has not been built with much security. The internet was built to allow a lot of communication, right? And security has been kind of this thing you've done after the fact. It'd be like if every house in America was built with no locks on it, and then suddenly we realize everybody's breaking in, we need to do something about it. And the Internet of Things is all these connected network devices that are so wicked cool, like Nest thermostats and, cameras that you can go on your phone and look at the camera overlooking your house, your router, all sorts of items.
Sort of boring day-to-day stuff.
that gets connected to the internet, so you can do stuff with it on your phone. So, I mean, they've got refrigerators now, and famously, perhaps, there's Crock-Pot. I don't really know why you'd want an internet-connected Crock-Pot, but there is one. Well, these things are being put out there, but there's no security on them. And so bad guys are sneaking onto them and then using them as launching pads to send the glop, the bad email. And they're using the Internet of Things to launch these distributed denial-of-service attacks.
So not to overplay this, Dave, but this was a huge, huge, huge deal and a huge, huge, huge concern.
A huge concern, as I say, because Dyn was ready for it and they still couldn't handle it. So the size of it was staggering. Something called the Mirai botnet, basically bot as in software robot, and net is there's a connected network of them smuggled into Internet of Things all over the country. And somebody said, okay, guys, attack Dyn. And since this happened, the Mirai botnet has actually gotten stronger, and another botnet has shown up that's even bigger. So the possibility exists that somebody somewhere, maybe it's the Russians, maybe it's the Chinese, maybe it's some kid in a basement, can take down something as big as Dyn for a while.
Well, very creepy. And Sam, I don't have an internet-connected crock pot, but I do plug it into an electrical outlet when I use it. And one vulnerability that a lot of people worry about, just in general, never mind this Dyn hack, is our electrical grid. So what does all this news about hacking mean for safety and reliability there?
Well, so one of the things that Dave mentioned is the Nest thermostat, which is an internet-connected thermostat. And when we talk about how the electrical grid is expected to change in the future, there's a lot of talk about the grid going two ways, communication on the grid going in two directions. And so, for instance, if there's a day in which there's expected to be a lot of demand and prices are expected to be very, very high, you could an electric utility could do something like send a signal to a lot of Nest thermostats or other internet-connected thermostats all around the region and ask people to, a million homes to turn down the temperature in their house by 1 degree. And that would have a huge impact on the amount of demand on the grid. It would lower prices for everybody and theoretically save a lot of money. However, all of that is dependent on a very secure Internet of Things. And if we don't figure out how to make those secure, then this new sort of two-way grid is not something that can really materialize. And I think that this is, for me at least, what is the most interesting upshot of all this is that all these manufacturers that make these devices are going to have to get really serious about security. I mean, there's been talk of penalties for devices that don't have security. So some sort of new regulation that would require this of all of those cameras and thermostats and crockpots. And how to do that is obviously a technical question that I'm not equipped to answer. I've heard talk of people using blockchain, which is this code that was used in Bitcoin to make Bitcoin secure, as something that could be used. But who knows is basically the answer. So it's a really interesting time. And I think what this attack did is really throw kind of a big monkey wrench in a lot of the revolutionary ideas that people talk about that the Internet of Things will be able to do. It's sort of like, yes, all that revolution can happen, but first the security has to be right first.
And does the security get so great, Sam, that it bogs down the benefits?
Yeah, or make it too expensive does the cost benefit disappear because these devices become too expensive? Who knows?
And you and I have talked a lot about this idea of a smarter grid, and the example you gave was great. And so, Dave, there's sort of a push-pull here. I mean, you want to make the grid more efficient. By doing so, you connect it to the internet, but lo and behold, it's not safe out there.
Absolutely. The example that many people point to happened a year or two ago in Ukraine. An entire city of 60-some-odd thousand people lost all their power for about 6 hours because there was a hack of the grid, probably by the Russians. Or another scary one you want. Happened in a Finnish city that I wrote down, but I cannot pronounce it, so I won't even try. Two apartment buildings had their heating systems shut down.
Yikes.
By DDoS attacks in wintertime in Finland. That's not good. This was last month. So one thing the Internet of Things has done, and it's made the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of the internet move from inside your computer to the world around you.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, Sam. It is striking because, you think of a hack and you think, all right, so maybe for a day or two I won't be able to, buy those airline tickets that I wanted to.
Get
but this
Twitter.
Is like I can't sit there in the shivering cold.
Yeah, and so certainly that's something that people will have to consider and perhaps will be considering more seriously now when they're doing things like buying internet-connected thermostats. I know where Dave sits on this question. Shinney is on the record as saying he would never have one. I have an internet-connected thermostat in my house. I think it's great.
Yeah, I know. I hacked into it.
but that's a consideration. You'll have to weigh for yourself, and you'll have to, you know, people have to educate themselves about how secure the device that they choose is.
Well, sure. And if you're not home all day, and you know, you don't need to heat the whole house, so it would be nice to say, "Darn it, I forgot to turn down the thermostat when I left." But then there are these vulnerabilities. Well, on the more positive end on this story, Dave, describe how UNH's Interoperability Lab is taking on this vulnerability question in the Internet of Things.
Sure. The IOL, which is much easier to say than Interoperability Lab, it's got really a national, maybe an international reputation for doing testing and setting of standards for Internet and online and computer devices. And they have very recently launched a testing lab for Internet of Things security specifically because of this. And rightly so. And I think that's a great thing. It's going to keep them on the forefront. And that's what we need. Part of the problem is it's not entirely clear what the best way is to make all these different devices secure.
So. All right. Well, let's move on, gentlemen. Lots of other science and tech headlines in 2016 that I want to cover with you. And then a little bit later in the show, we'll get your predictions for the new year. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. What do you think were the most intriguing New Hampshire science and tech stories of the past year? What science stories caught your ear, from tech to the environment? And what do you think has the most significant event been in New Hampshire science news? Again, we'd love to hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, guys, from some disturbing news to some exciting news, and Dave, I'll start with you. New Hampshire seems to be attracting a lot more biotech firms, including a major announcement at the end of the year. Boy, you could hear the cheering all over the state.
Absolutely.
A new biotech research institute. This is a national initiative with buy-in from the federal government, some prestigious research universities from around the country. This is a huge deal, Dave. What's the goal?
So the goal basically is to do a better job of helping wounded veterans, although obviously it could help anybody, through new technologies for tissues and organ replacement. So it's called the Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute. It's one of a number of such biotech manufacturing institutes that the feds are sort of trying to prod around the country. The number was tossed around about $80 million in federal money, a couple hundred million dollars probably in private money. It's going to be sort of headed by UNH Manchester, DECA Research, which is Dean Kamen's organization there. And again, this is the Manchester Mill Yard we're talking about, and Dartmouth Hitchcock. Details are still being worked out. It's unclear about how much actual research and manufacturing will happen in the Mill Yard, how much of it will be sort of organizing research around the country. But the idea is to use new technologies such as 3D printing or regenerative growth in order to replace tissue. So if you got a bad burn, you can 3D print a new tissue and put it right on your arm and it would grow it back. Or even, you know, use cell lines that can grow replacement organs. That's a ways down the road, but this is a way to focus the research on manufacturing and development aspects that can actually make this happen in 3 to 5 years.
Wow, maybe. I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping my jaw closed.
Yeah,
today because it is jaw dropping to think about. You can 3D print some tissue to repair a burn.
Yeah, they're already kind of doing that in some places. I mean, there's all sorts of problems, and it's not something you're gonna go down to your local convenience center and have it done tomorrow. But it's not as crazy as it sounds.
Why Manchester, Sam? It's a big honor for the Queen City.
Well, if you look just south of our border, I mean, there's a huge biotech corridor in sort of just west of Boston area. I have friends who out of college got incredible jobs in the biotech center. They're very well paid. They're very happy to be there. And it's sort of, you have people referring to this area as the Silicon Valley of the East. I mean, it's really, really booming.
Right.
But costs are quite high in Massachusetts. I mean, like land is scarcer than up here. I mean, talking to those friends about what homes cost, for instance, is a little shocking. You know, even on the seacoast, where we think things are very expensive, they think it's very reasonable. So I think it's no surprise that some of that wealth is starting to sort of expand its way north of Massachusetts, looking for perhaps a lower cost environment, but still within a reasonable commute of that center.
To the universities and the other firms located on that Route 128 corridor, exactly. And
yeah,
so forth.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting that, you know, the Mill Yard, formerly the center of the textile industry, is now attracting, you know, not only technology companies, but this amazing biotech institute. You know, Sam, this is a little off topic, but we have talked a lot on this program about New Hampshire's so-called demographic problem. So how does this new institute help with that?
Well, I mean, I think that's an open question. We know that university towns are good for the economy. We know that those towns tend to weather economic booms and busts better than other towns. And in theory, this could help to attract people who are looking for those kinds of well-paid jobs that we were just talking about in Massachusetts. Of course, unemployment is very low here. So the question is, will any company that establishes itself have a hard time attracting enough help to fill their positions? But you know, it's certainly a good sign.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
And this is a pattern that's happened before, which is, you know, techie stuff bleeding up over the border from Massachusetts. Anybody old enough remember when Digital Equipment Corporation moved up and established Nashua or Oracle or places like that? It was startling and exciting. What are they doing up in New Hampshire? And obviously the pharmaceutical companies that have come up the coast and are there in the seacoast. And so this just seems to be the next wave of that, of all the tech stuff in Massachusetts coming up here. And you're right, mostly for costs, let's be honest.
Well, another biotech question for you, Dave. You've done some stories on some other biotech research hubs that are emerging in New Hampshire, including an initiative called CRISPR, which sounds like a drawer for your lettuce. What is that?
Okay, so CRISPR is a technology, basically a way to easily edit genes. Genetic material, and it is the big thing that has happened in biology in the last 3 to 5 years, and it allows genetic modification to happen much more easily and much more readily, both for good and for ill, and it is combining now with a concept called gene drives, and gene drives are the portions of the chromosome that are more readily inherited. So most of your chromosome, you know, there's a 50% chance you'll inherit it. If your dad's got some, your mom's got some, there's a 50% chance. Gene drives are portions of it, which there's a more than a 50% chance. If you can go in and edit gene drive portion of the chromosome, then whatever you're editing, whatever you're changing, will more likely spread through the population.
So examples that you gave in your story, again, for good and for ill.
You
can think of
all
sorts of creepy scenarios.
Well, yeah, but the really exciting one that's happened, and certainly exciting for us, is using it to target Lyme disease. And there is a very interesting program that is might be coming to Nantucket, the Isle of Nantucket, which has just a horrendous Lyme disease problem. But obviously it's an island. It's contained. So what there is proposals to do is to genetically modify mice so that they cannot pass on the virus, because the tick gets it, but the mice are really part of the chain. If the mice can't pass it on, the virus will not be passed on. The ticks won't get it, and when they bite us, they won't give us the virus.
Well, couldn't you just make a vaccine for Lyme? Wouldn't that be a lot more effective? I mean, rather than targeting mice, I mean, there are other creatures that also carry Lyme-infected ticks.
There are, and a vaccine is
seems
is
sort of
good
a backwards
idea.
Way to do it.
On the contrary, I think it's a brilliant idea, although because it's brilliant, it has the possibility of you know, huge drawbacks. The vaccines are hard to do. They're hard to make. They're hard to make them work well, and they always have side effects. If you can do it directly, if you can affect the disease in the wild, that's better.
All right. Coming up, we will turn to climate change, some of the science headlines around that, and a little bit later, we'll look at some other science and tech headlines, including advances in renewable energy battery storage. All that plus your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the top New Hampshire science and tech stories of 2016. Let's hear from you. What science and technology issues caught your attention this year? Which ones do you want to know more about? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Sam Evans Brown is here, host of NHPR's Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it, along with Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek. And guys, let's turn to climate change. And Sam, to you first, please. According to state researchers, and UNH does a ton of research on climate change, what impacts did we see this past year?
Well, obviously, this year we had a we saw year two of a historic drought, which you know, droughts, the attribution science is always a tricky thing to get into, but droughts are something that's predicted to be more intense as climate change progresses. This was also the hottest year on record globally. But then, you know, outside of New Hampshire, the most dramatic impacts that we were seeing were up in the Arctic. I mean, the poles, for those who haven't heard this trivia, the poles are expected and in fact, we are observing them to warm much more quickly than the mid-latitudes in the tropics. So things were very, very steamy up especially the Arctic this year. This is the lowest year on record in a really dramatic way for Arctic sea ice. And that's something that I think has got a lot of climate scientists freaking out a little bit. This is also just generally, you know, if we were to look at important research that came out this year, I'd say it's generally was the year of ice. Early on in 2016, we saw two really high profile studies about, you know, upping our prediction of the expected sea level rise that we are anticipating over the course of the next 100 years. You know, 1 to 3 feet was the number that had been bandied around for a long time as the consensus number. Both of these studies were looking at more the 3 to 6 foot range. And so we're, you know, what I'd say is probably, you can probably take away from this is that, you know, the science is tending towards a higher rate of rise. So we're expecting to see more sea level rise sooner than what the previous science had predicted. And that, you know, frankly, for me, looking at the impacts of climate change is the one that is probably the most dramatic. A figure that I heard when working on a big story about this earlier in the year was that for every inch of sea level rise in the United States, there are 100,000 homes on the coast that will be affected.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. And so when people say, oh, a foot, what's a foot? Well, a foot is over a million homes that now have the tide lapping up around their foundation every time the tide rises.
Well, and so if 2016 in technology was the year of the hack, it sounds like in terms of science, Sam, 2016 was the year of ice.
That's the way I read it.
Well, and Dave, you've written about this in terms of New Hampshire, especially the impacts on our seacoast. So what did you find?
Well, before I get into it, let me say he's quite correct, is that what happened in the Arctic in particular this year, in the last 2 years, is startling. I'm older than Sam, so I've been writing about climate change a lot longer. And until the last couple of years, I thought it was this interesting thing that was kind of alarming. But the last 2 years, what has happened in the Arctic, there were days in the Arctic when the temperature was more than 30 degrees above the normal. That's, you know, we're not talking about 1, 2, 3, 5 degrees, 30 degrees above the normal.
It causes a lot of melt.
It's unprecedented, and it's like the whole system is being reset. I think it's fair to say that what is happening at the poles is at the upper end of the worst case scenarios of what you were hearing about 5 and 10 years ago.
So what's the impact here, Dave?
Okay, what's the impact here? The big impact is king tides, as you mentioned. That's the most obvious one right now. Is you get a high tide when it's a full moon, and you go walking down on the beach along the seacoast, and you're going to see water lapping up where it didn't used to lap up, and that's going to happen regularly. It's going to happen more and more. And so we've built seawalls, and we've built roads, and we have beaches we like to go play on, and they're going to be slowly, maybe not so slowly, covered by tides.
So look out Hampton Beach, huh?
Yeah,
all
those lovely little rocks, you know, the kids like to play in and find the little sea creatures. They're going to be deeper and deeper underwater.
Yeah, Strawberry Bank, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. NPR had a piece this morning about losing, you know, significant amounts of historical sites and homes in Louisiana because of sea level rise. So, and Sam also talked about the drought, though, Dave, and it does seem weird to talk about sort of more water and drought at the same time.
It does. And in fact, there was a study released yesterday. Not only was 2016 the hottest globally, the hottest year globally. It was the wettest year globally in the sense of the most amount of moisture in the atmosphere.
And yet we had all this drought.
And yet we had all this drought. And more moisture in the atmosphere makes sense because warmer air can hold more moisture. So that you this was expected. But part of what this does is it alters the weather patterns that have existed because a lot of that is driven by moisture in the air and patterns of moisture in the air. And so what happens is you are expecting to see more extremes in terms of moisture, extremes as in you don't get much, extremes as in you get a lot. And you know, take a look at California, which has had a five-year drought, and they're about to enter what looks like at least a short-term flood period. So you'll be hearing all these stories about mudslides in Southern California.
Sam?
I was just going to say that you know, when we talk about extremes, I mean, I think that is exactly the right word, that one of the predictions that climate scientists have been telling us that we should expect here in New Hampshire are more extreme downpours, which is to say that we might get more rain, but we're going to get it all at the same time.
So that's not helpful.
Right. And so you can have extreme rain coexisting with droughts and sort of have the, you know, both problems at the same time.
So you've got the rain, but it's not helpful because it washes off very quickly on the soil, which is parched from the drought, it rushes right into the rivers.
Sort of in, you sort of have this boom and bust of rivers,
right?
Where you have huge flow one day and then trickles the next.
Yeah, and so it doesn't help the whole ecosystem. It doesn't help regenerate the soil because it runs off too quickly.
And we are still in a drought, even though it's, you know, all the rain we had yesterday and all that. If you look at the subsurface water levels, you'll find that we are still absolutely in a drought. These are the aquifers that you and I use our wells come from. So they are not being recharged very much at the moment. Ground's frozen. Guess what? Water doesn't go down to them. So in springtime, you have to hope for lots and lots of snow in the North Country and lots of snow melt.
Well, a couple more questions on climate science, what we learned this year about New Hampshire. But I also want to invite our listeners to join us. Again, the number here in the exchange as we look at some of the top science and technology headlines of 2016 is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And guys, here's an email from Susie who says, the advances and issues of 2016 you've mentioned so far are all interesting, but what about denial of science being elevated to the level of presidential discourse? Susie says, I'm mainly thinking of the president-elect's repeated assertion that climate change is unrelated to human activity and the whole notion of climate change is a ruse. Susie, thank you for the email. I did want to ask you guys, you, Sam, first, UNH does a ton of climate research, especially looking at the impacts here in the Granite State. So what does this skepticism by the incoming administration mean for that research?
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to shy away from speculating here because I think there's two things going on. One is that, you know, a lot of the indications that I think we've seen from the appointments that the new administration is making are not great for climate science. That's certainly true. I mean, there was many people will likely have heard of the questionnaire that was circulated amongst a number of departments looking for staff who had been working on climate change issues. Many of the departments declined to answer those questionnaires. And certainly the climate scientists themselves are quite concerned. I mean, we've heard reports of people going in and backing up all of the federal data, climate data that's being accumulated by the federal government so that should the government decide to completely wipe clean its climate data databases, there'll be a backup of it. Heard Governor Brown in California say that if the federal government decides to stop collecting data from satellites, they'd have to launch their own satellites. So people are concerned. But I'd say that the countervailing force is that there is quite a lot of public attention on this. And you know, we saw during, for instance, the Reagan administration, the amount of pushback against the administration can lead to changes within the bureaucracies. You know, people who are climate deniers may not keep their jobs for terribly long. So, I'm going to shy away from making predictions, but I will say that the indications we have so far is that this is not an administration that's friendly towards climate science generally.
And one last question on this for you, Dave Brooks. We did a whole program a couple weeks back about how seacoast communities are preparing for greater floods and higher tides. What's the forecast there, Dave, and how are communities on the seacoast, regardless of the politics of this, looking to get ready?
Well, you're right about regardless of the politics, because seacoast communities are facing, you know, the reality. It's one thing. Well, anyway, it's difficult to say no when they're, you know, the seawater is all around your feet. So the main things that most of them are doing is looking at infrastructure. So, for really simple stuff like if you're building a new police station on next to the beach, make sure you don't put the heating system in the basement so it won't flood.
The nitty-gritty, huh?
To me, the essence of this is the culvert, which is as boring an object as you can find. But culverts have traditionally been sized sort of randomly. I once heard one guy talk about how the standard size for culvert was designed because it's big enough that a basketball won't get stuck in it. So if people throw basketballs, they won't stick and block up your culvert. But culverts are now being redesigned so that although they've done fine for the last 100 years with the amount of water that flows through them, if you're going to get these new storms, suddenly they're going to wash out, and replacing a culvert that's washed out is very expensive. So that's the sort of thing. They're also looking at their environmental issues. So, for example, the seagrasses and other natural forces that can absorb water and can absorb storms surges are going to be swamped, and they're going to be covered by the ocean, and they're going to die, and you're going to lose that protection. So the question is, can you migrate them inland so that they still exist even as the sea rises, and they will continue to provide both some environmental benefits and also some protection? And but you're going to get down to things like, what are you going to do about property values? There are some people, I've seen estimates that, tens of trillions of dollars worth of property value, this is dollars, folks, very important stuff, is going to become worthless in the next 30 to 50 years because of sea level rise along the coast. And that could, what's that going to do to the economy? So you need to start preparing for that. How much of your tax base, if you're, Hampton, how much of your tax base is going to be rendered less valuable by the sea rise? You need to start thinking about that.
So. Well, and when you talk about culverts, let's remember that a too small culvert in the mid-2000s led to the deaths of some people in Alstead. I mean, this is...
Sure.
It needs to be bigger than a basketball, is what we're discovering. All right. Again, Susie, thank you for the email. The email address for you to join us is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Dave Brooks and Sam Evans Brown. And today in the Exchange, we're wrapping up some of the top science and technology energy environment stories of the past year. There was a lot that went on, so we're getting an update on that. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. And Sam, I want to ask you about another subject that you've done a lot of coverage on, and that's renewable energy and how one of the big challenges is storage. So just describe that challenge for us, please.
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny. A lot of people associate storage with renewable energy, but there's a thinker who I listen to a lot who says that storage is the bacon of the grid. It just makes everything better. So storage in a lot of ways...
I had not heard that.
Yeah, storage in a lot of ways... yes, people think of it because we're going to need a lot of storage when there's a lot of renewable energy on the grid. However, there are enough challenges with the grid already that putting storage on the grid now could be useful, even though we don't have a terribly large amount of variable renewable energy. And this we're seeing down in Massachusetts, which is now looking at having a storage mandate in the coming years. They want to encourage the utilities to put in 600 megawatts of battery storage of some sort by 2025. 600 megawatts, we're talking about enough batteries that it's roughly the size of sort of a mid-sized power plant. Seabrook is 1,200 megawatts, and that's a big one. 600 is about half that. And even now, before renewable energy has become a big thing on the grid, the study that recommended this target says that there could be as much as $3 billion in system benefits from the storage every year. And the reason for that is that, energy, there's the cost of energy varies wildly from minute to minute. Every 5 minutes, there's a new price of energy.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
There's an auction every 5 minutes for electricity.
And Sam is bored, he watches it on
the internet. I tweet out really high prices.
But wait, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Sam, but just back up a little bit for us, please. Just remind us that some people say the problem with solar and wind energy is it's there when the sun shines, it's there when the wind blows, but you can't store it. So just That's the problem that people are trying to fix, right?
Actually, no. That's not the problem people are trying to fix. The problem that people are trying to fix is that 10% of our electricity is costing us 40% of our cost. That's the problem that the storage is actually aimed at. It's not aimed at renewable energy.
I see.
And so that's what I was saying at the beginning. Most people think of it as a renewable energy problem, but really it's just good for the grid because there are these moments.
No matter where the energy is produced.
Yeah. There are moments, Laura, where we have really high demand, where we are firing up turbines that are fueled by jet fuel. That is really expensive. And if you can avoid turning those on, that saves everyone money. And that's really what this storage is based on. And that's kind of what's exciting about it is, you know, if the only reason we're installing storage is because we're trying to roll out renewable energy, it may never happen. But if we're installing storage because it's going to save money, it'll happen more quickly. And so you know, 600 megawatts down in Massachusetts, it's creating a lot of buzz. There's also a new battery facility that was just installed over in Portland, Maine. So, you know, things are actually happening. We've been talking about energy storage for so long, and it seems like it's actually sort of on the cusp of getting onto the grid.
So this has to do, and I know you did a lot of reporting on this too, Sam, this has to do with that moment, I can't remember if it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, where, you know, it was cold, New England faced sort of a brownout or a freeze out or whatever, and energy prices spiked, and they were literally turning on the heat with jet fuel. So that's partly what this is aimed
at. Yeah, moments like that. There was one this summer, for instance, in August when we had really, really high demand because it was very, very hot, lots of people turning on their air conditioning. And we saw prices, you know, normally we're talking like $20 to $40 a megawatt hour. We saw prices that were like $2,000 a megawatt hour. So that's the moment this storage is aimed at.
Okay, and people could also deal with that. The air conditioning issue by just turning it up a degree or two, since most offices and restaurants and movie theaters are freezing.
Yeah.
But that's my own thing. Stephanie is joining us from Exeter. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering, if you were to live another 50 to 100 years, what part of New Hampshire would you feel most comfortable climate-wise having your home?
Stephanie, thank you so much. And living in Exeter, that's sort of on the seacoast, but not right on the water. Dave, you want to talk about that?
Well, I'm not a beach guy anyway, so let's be honest. I much prefer the mountains anyway. But I would be very leery about owning property that was terribly close to the ocean coastline. Not just because I'm afraid about the ocean, you know, coming into my living room, but because I'm afraid about the ocean rising enough that salt water will get into the freshwater aquifers that I use for my well. That's actually a real big problem, or a potential problem that's happening. So I would move inland, young man.
So I will say that for people who are really interested in this, there's some resources they can avail themselves of, which are, you know, the University of New Hampshire has these great maps that are created with LIDAR, which is, you know, sort of laser radar, very, very accurate maps of how much sea level rise one can expect. And, you know, there are parts of Exeter, you know, Exeter's the sort of head of the tide. So there are some spots where the tide might be rising a bit. But I will say that, you know, we're not talking about most of New Hampshire disappearing. We only have 16 miles or what?
18.
Excuse me. 18 miles of coast. So it's you should look at those maps and judge based on that. However, you know, there are a lot of considerations to make, like Dave said, with fresh water. And, you know, maybe you, if you still want to ski, maybe you want to head north.
Well, Great Bay, too, though, even though we only have 17, 18 miles of actual coast, Sam, there's that enormous Great Bay. So if you add that in, that's a lot more so-called coastline.
Indeed. And you can look at flooding models for the Great Bay as well and make your decision from there.
Okay. Well, Stephanie, thanks for the call. And after a short break, we'll take a lot more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. We'll turn to a couple other science, technology, environment headlines, including what happened with moose and bobcats in 2016. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what do you think the top New Hampshire science and technology stories were this past year? And what are you looking forward to in the new year? Our guests are Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor, blogger at Granite Geek. Dave will be at the Science Cafe New Hampshire in Nashua tonight. They'll be talking about cybersecurity, which we talked about earlier in the hour. Also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. By the way, Outside Magazine named Outside In the best podcast of 2016, and Runner's World also named it one of the best podcasts of the year. You can join us with your questions and comments about some of the headlines that we've been talking about, the big science and technology stories of the past year. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. And guys, looking back in 2016, Granite Staters saw a lot of headlines about two iconic critters. First, Sam Evans Brown, the moose. UNH and Fish and Game have been studying what's happening to these fabulous animals. What did we learn this past year?
Well, so it's a 6-year study. It'll go on for a number of time, for a long time. They're putting radio collars on moose and seeing how many of them survive from year to year. And basically, the takeaway from this year of the study is that things keep getting worse. You know, the first year of the study, we had 64% calf mortality, 74% the year after that, and now we're up to 80% calf mortality.
So that means 80% of the moose calves who were born die?
80% of the moose calves that they collared died. So you know, they've put on enough that if they think that's a representative sample. You know, adult mortality is lower, down around 22%. But, you know, it's a big deal. I mean, there's a number of things that are affecting the moose, obviously. The big one that people talk about a lot is winter tick. There are more ticks on the moose. There are more ticks out there in the world. They're not dying as quickly or as often in the winters because the winters aren't severe enough. But also you've got deer populations that are creeping their way north. And so there are other parasites that are getting into the moose population because of deer feces getting into onto the foliage that they're browsing. So, you know, it's a complicated problem, and it's pretty sad. I mean, it's an iconic creature that I think, you know, we're definitely not going to see as many of them in the future, and we may not see any of them at all unless you really look for them.
Well, and just a quick aside on that story, Sam, you talked about collaring the moose calves and that huge die-off rate. I think I read some concern that collaring the moose is stressful for them and that might not be helpful when they're already in a stressed state.
Yeah, in the first year of the study, there were a number of moose calves that were actually killed by the process because
not the point.
Yeah, and you know, Fish and Game got some flack for that, and it was based on the quantity of tranquilizer, I believe, that the animals were given. They were sort of overdosed by accident. We haven't seen that since the first year of the study. So yeah, it certainly is stressful for the creatures, but you know, sort of in the name of science, trying to figure out what's going on with them, and hopefully something good will come out of the science. So you know, there's a cost benefit that's there, and people, you know, obviously Fish and Game and UNH feel that it's worth it.
All right. Well, in a minute we'll talk about another New Hampshire animal whose populations had a much healthier year last year. That's the bobcat. We'll turn to that in a minute. But let's go back to our listeners, guys. And Ruth is joining us from Canterbury. Hi, Ruth. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
And I wanted to talk about another iconic species in New Hampshire, which is the bald eagle, and certainly had a much more positive outcome than the moose, because this year we were able to take it off the threatened endangered species list in New Hampshire thanks to the 30-year effort by New Hampshire Audubon and New Hampshire Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and tons of volunteers and staff working to help bring back that amazing bird. In 1988, we had no nesting bald eagles, and now we have over 50 pairs in the state.
Well, Ruth, I'm so glad you called, because I had forgotten about that. So just remind us again, the bald eagle used to be on which list?
The endangered
species list. Okay, that's
both federally and in New Hampshire. Then it was downlisted to the threatened list. And this year, they've been talking about taking it off completely because of the success.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Dave, this is a major story and a positive development.
It's a good news story. I guess environmentalists are allowed to talk about good news. I didn't think that was – anyway. So and it's part of a bigger picture, which is interesting, is that raptors in general, so, you know, meat-eating birds, are doing pretty darn well. In fact, they're doing as well as any of the birds. You know, ospreys, you know, you see owls around that you didn't used to see. I certainly see red-tailed hawks normally, much to the dismay of my chicken farming neighbors. For whatever reason, and I think part of it has been the changes that have happened in New Hampshire over the last 30, 40, 50 years is the end of large-scale agriculture, and the returning of the woods is just the environment has changed enough that the raptors are doing well. And bald eagles are obviously an iconic example of that And I just have to wonder how long it'll be before they start becoming annoying, because they really are kind of an annoying bird. They're basically, you know, we like to think of them as being noble hunters, but really, you know, they're scavengers, and they beat up on other birds and steal their food.
Well, in fact, we did a loon show, another iconic, to overuse that word, New Hampshire creature that is still in trouble. And some people called, Dave, and said they'd seen bald eagles picking on loons. They didn't like that.
You know, nature red in tooth and claw, as the saying goes, is absolutely true. Yeah, you're right.
Well, Ruth, thank you for reminding us of that. That's an important headline from last year that I had forgotten about. So thank you. And let's go next to Kevin in Manchester. Hi, Kevin. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question for your panelists, whether or not they've heard any research studies or things are being looked at for the coastal protection and storm surge issue about using storm barriers to help protect Portsmouth and or the Great Bay Area, kind of like they have done down in Providence, Rhode Island, to actually block off the river from any storm surge coming in.
Kevin, this is a great question. And in addition to what our guests have to say, I would turn you to our show a couple weeks ago on how Seacoast communities are preparing. You can listen to the show, or there's a lot of links and so forth to the report. But go ahead, Sam. It's an important point. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, indeed. The UNH and others, you know, Department of Environmental Services, are looking at this quite carefully. And I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but I don't. There's actually already a huge percentage of the New Hampshire coast that has been hardened already in terms of, you know, putting up seawalls and barriers of other sorts. And then they're also doing a lot of these same researchers are doing a lot of work into looking what would the best type of barriers be, because it's, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it. You know, you can just heap a mound of rubble in front of the buildings that you're trying to project, which is both not particularly aesthetic and perhaps something you're going to have to constantly be repairing. Or there's talk of doing sort of softer interventions just offshore that would sort of dampen the surge as it's coming in.
Like what?
So you can, I mean, there's lots of ways.
Seawalls are kind of ugly.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the ways people are talking about it are sort of mimicking natural systems. So creating sort of like artificial reef type structures that'll slow the surge, not necessarily eliminate it, but just reduce the impact. And a lot of this question is not what can we do, but what should we do, right? I mean, you can create a lot of very expensive infrastructure, but what is the cost benefit of that? And so they're looking at things that are perhaps a little less expensive, but would have a lot of impact in terms of reducing damage, maybe just not eliminating it entirely.
Wow, interesting. Dave, do you want to jump in on that too?
Sam knows a lot more about it than I do, but I know there's even been talk. So down in, it was either Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, there was some rich guy who wanted to buy a boat and sink it just offshore to protect his house. It would not be, the boat would not have been visible above the water, but it would slow down the surge coming through the ocean. So, but I believe the community frowned on that.
Okay, well, all sorts of ideas are welcome, I guess, right, Sam?
Yeah, and again, it's this cost question. I mean, if you look at the Netherlands, who have a 100-year plan for how they're going to combat climate change, they're talking about spending billions of dollars every year to protect their coastline. And if you sort of, you know, superimpose the amount of coast that they have onto the United States and the amount of coast that we have, protecting everything is a very expensive proposition. And what's not clear is what amount of political will there is to spend that kind of money. So that's really the open question. As opposed to what can we do, it's what are we willing to pay for.
Well, Kevin, again, I'd refer you to the study that we looked at a couple weeks ago about Seacoast communities getting ready. And thank you very much for the question. And another one from Manchester, guys. This is Julia calling in. Hi, Julia. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, why don't we have variable rates for electricity use such that we pay more during peak hours and we pay less during off-peak hours?
Julia, it's a great question, and you made Sam Evans Brown's day because he loves looking at this. Go ahead, Sam.
Okay, I'm just going to, you know, wander away for a while.
Yeah, so the answer to that is that we don't have the metering infrastructure out there. We need smart meters if we want to pay variable rates.
Which are connected to the internet.
Which are connected to the internet.
Which is vulnerable, which we talked about before.
And not only that, but you know, smart meters— are pretty new still. And if you look at what's happened with the New Hampshire Electric Cooperative, they got money through ARRA funds, the stimulus package through Obama's stimulus package to put smart meters on all of their customers' homes. And those smart meters were faulty. They're now suing the company. They've had to delay the rollout of their sort of grid 2.0 program that they announced at the beginning of this year. So there are complications. It would be a whole new way of paying for electricity, and it'll take a while just to get the sort of nuts and bolts technical infrastructure in place. However, there are lots and lots of people talking about, you know, paying a variable rate that is more reflective of how electricity is actually generated, so you can send a price signal to customers and you know, hopefully save everybody money. In fact, a big MIT study just came out, I think, 2 weeks ago called The Utility of the Future, and that's exactly what they recommended is, you know, everyone should be on variable rates. Everyone should have smart meters. You know, they should also have locational rates. So if you're in a place that it costs more money to get the electricity to you, that maybe you should be paying a little more for that, too.
Sure, if you live way out in the country and there's a long line to get it to you.
Or just if you're in a place where there's a lot of congestion, not enough electricity lines feeding that spot, you know, you'd pay a higher rate and therefore you'd have more incentive to install perhaps some solar panels on your roof.
Interesting. Well, so as you can hear, Julia, it's something that a lot of people are looking at. Go ahead,
Dave. Yeah, and that's really going to happen. I can absolutely see people saying, hey, this is awesome. I get to pay more for my electricity than the guy down the street of the way the system is set up.
Right, or that I happen to live out in this, you know, my family estate that has been in the family forever and it happens to be far out and that's not fair and so forth.
The MIT study is sort of the cold, clean world of academia, not necessarily the real world.
Easy for them to say. Julia, thank you so much for the call. And guys, before we go back to our listeners, we should talk about another animal that made huge headlines, maybe even one of the biggest New Hampshire headlines in addition to the election, of course, and that's the bobcat. So just remind us, Sam, what happened to this lovely cat.
Yeah, so it began even in 2015. There was a proposal to open a season on trapping of bobcats. It's something that had been closed for a very, very long time because bobcat populations had crashed. But we've seen, you know, a lot of sort of anecdotal evidence and also then a UNH and Fish and Game joint study that found that indeed the number of bobcats has rebounded in the state, and Fish and Game proposed reopening a trapping season on them to huge public outcry. And what we saw was a prolonged campaign by the sort of anti-trapping forces that eventually, you know, started with Fish and Game, worked its way into the legislature after the rule had been approved in Fish and Game, and it went to the legislature, and the legislature had some concerns about, you know, are these trappers going to be accidentally catching endangered Canadian lynx? And finally, with those concerns from the legislature, Fish and Game dropped it. So as a result of this prolonged anti-trapping campaign, the rule fell by the wayside, and we're not talking about it anymore except for on year-end review programs.
Well, it was a huge, huge story, you know, front page and all that. And Dave, what does it say to you, this whole episode, this sort of push-pull that we saw over bobcats, what does this say to you about the people of the Granite State and their values and how they've changed?
Well, and that's why it was such a big story. You know, if you've been talking about, you know, the opossum hunting season, I don't think you would have seen much outcry. The bobcat is a gorgeous animal. It's new. It's a symbol of the wild. There's something about carnivores in the wild that just are very symbolic, particularly those of us who don't have to fear from them, who live in suburbia or cities. We like the idea that there are dangerous animals out there in the wild in our state. It just seems interesting. So a lot of the debate was a reflection of, you know, what is Fish and Game? What are we doing with our outdoors? How much of it is for the hunters? And how much of it is for the hikers? I mean, that's sort of your classic split. But it's an example of how New Hampshire is changing and trying to figure out how we can still say New Hampshire in many important ways and yet deal with the way we're changing.
Let's go back. Oh, go ahead.
And the bobcat population, the latest study, it does seem to be doing quite well. We don't have super awesomely accurate numbers. They're a little difficult animal to get a hold of. But they are another example of how predators of a certain size are thriving in the way New Hampshire is changing.
Charismatic megafauna.
I don't think the bobcat is quite megafauna, but
no.
They are charismatic.
Yeah.
They're very charismatic.
Right. Well, as an owner of two cats, I can attest to how difficult they are to track down sometimes. Let's go back to our listeners. Brad joins us from Madison. Hi, Brad. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. I just wondered if Sam and Dave have any information concerning the rising water and the Seabrook nuclear power plant.
Well, and this was also a concern by that group on the seacoast that has been looking at this. So thank you so much, Brad. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, so I did a story on this a number of years ago, and basically as I, you know, looked at those UNH studies of LIDAR and talked to folks who are sort of in the know on this, basically what I heard is that this isn't a huge concern, that Seabrook has sort of adequate defenses for the amount of storm surge that's expected, and that even with if we had 3 feet of sea level rise and a 12-foot storm surge, that Seabrook would be all right. And part of that is that the Seabrook is in the middle of a marsh, and marshes are excellent natural defenses against storm surge. The question then is, if we go beyond 3 feet of sea level rise, if some of these more apocalyptic concerns about sea level, come to pass. But again, those projections are looking at 2100. You know, will Seabrook still be in operation in 2100? That's an open question. I think likely not. That's basically what I heard.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a good point, Brad. And just real quick, guys, turning to 2017, Dave Brooks, what major science and technology stories will you be watching this year?
Well, there's no New Hampshire angle that I know of, but I'm very excited about the Cassini project, which after 20 years of flying and flying around Saturn is going to basically crash into the planet, go right between the rings, taking awesome photos the whole way. Your classic big science working well in space.
Sam?
So as a devout energy nerd, there are two big New Hampshire energy decisions coming. Eversource, formerly Public Service of New Hampshire, is going to be selling all of its power plants sometime early in 2017. And we're going to have a decision on net metering, which will have a huge impact on the way residential solar power develops in New Hampshire in the coming years.
Okay. And Dave, real quick, tonight, Science Cafe, New Hampshire, in Nashua, cybersecurity.
Cybersecurity and on January 17th, Tuesday, in Concord, electric cars. So there's another Science Cafe there.
All right. You can find out more information at nhpr.org. Dave Brooks, Sam Evans-Brown, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, reconsidering kindergarten. More than half of New Hampshire districts have full-day kindergarten. Now a new bill would double state aid for this, but some local officials say that wouldn't go nearly far enough. Meanwhile, some lawmakers are unsure whether the state should make this commitment or focus on other issues. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange. Tomorrow morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.